Welcome back to the South Harbor Church Podcast. South Harbor exists to help people find their way back to God. This week, Pastor Tim takes us through another look at the story of David and Goliath. As always, for more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, stick around after the message. And now, let's head over to Pastor Tim.
Glad you're with us. If it's your first time here, we're really grateful that you are that you're joining us today. So let me give you a little backstory. We're going to be in 1 Samuel 17. So if you want to find us in 1 Samuel chapter 17, a little backstory. So a couple of weeks ago, and I know it's summer, so not everyone's here every week. But if you're with us, you know that we, Chris Thompson, our student director, stood on our stage, and he had shared then that Jamestown Harbor Church, one of our sister churches, we planted Jamestown Harbor. A number of us kind of were sent 12 years ago or so. But they had been in a search process. And we're looking for a lead pastor. And he had shared his journey with us all and named that he was feeling called. And the community had discerned that they were feeling called toward him. And so his turn here as our student ministry director was wrapping up. And it was one of those days, if you're with us, it was like we laughed and there were some tears. I think in the first service, there was a standing ovation for Chris. And then there was the roast. Oh, you're right here. I'm staring right at Chris right now. Yeah. Oh, he's here. Okay. Seeing he's here, I can say this, we roasted Chris, right? Like as somebody who's got Dutch in me, one of the ways the Dutch show love is by being mean. I've learned that if somebody's not mean to you, I don't know that you can really trust them. They gotta it's gotta hurt a little bit. They called it the Dutch rub in my last church. So there was a little bit of roasting, and all of it was because Chris means a lot to us, and Chris Thompson has been a really great student director, student pastor here, but he's also just been a good friend, a good pastor to this community. And so he shared all that a few weeks ago, I guess now. And he had named them that. He's like, hey, but there will be one more time where we're going to get a chance to let's prolong the goodbye. Thursday at, I don't know, 1 o'clock, I get a text message from Chris that said, hey, can you preach for me Sunday? Chris was supposed to preach today. So he's like, hey, can you preach for me Sunday? Which I responded, I believe, congratulations, ! Because if you were aware of this, Chris's wife was pregnant, and their due date was right around here. And so the intention was that Chris would preach his kind of final sermon. I'm not Chris, but let me share with his permission. Here's his new baby boy, Bowden David. Yeah. So to Chris and Sam and the family, we're excited for this next chapter. Look at the size of the hands. That guy's going to be a baller. Bowden David. That means Chris is not. He doesn't get to share his last sermon with you, but he is here, so you can say goodbyes after the service. But so you're stuck with the B team this morning. I'm sorry, you're stuck with me. We'll see where this one goes. I had a full weekend planned, and so I did my best. But when Chris wrote, "Can you preach David and Goliath?" I'm like, yeah, I've taught David and Goliath a bunch of times, but initially what I did was I kind of sat down and I just started furiously typing some notes for what to share. And I got to a spot where it felt kind of gross, if I'm honest. Because the way a sermon tends to work in me is, and I shared this at Abby's ordination, that in the digital age, in the age of AI, I worry that a younger generation isn't going to have the sermon working on them first before they give it. We might have more well put together sermons from younger pastors, but there's something about the process of a sermon working on you. And admittedly, next week's sermon has been working on me for a while now, but this one hadn't been because David and Goliath is a story that is close to my heart. I love teaching the story, but at the same time, I wasn't asking the question that I tend to ask, which is, what is the thing, God, that you need me to see in the story? And then is there anything in the story that you need the congregation to see? And so I was feverishly typing notes and got to the spot where I realized I'm not, this will feel gross if I just do that. So I shut my computer and went for a walk with my Bernadoodle named Phil Collins. And we went and I just spent some time. Oh, that's a true story. I spent some time. I'm just kind of asking God, is there, like, what do you have for me to share in the David and Goliath story? And I think God gave me, or at least it feels right, that I have a conclusion to the sermon. The rest of the sermon, we're just going to, I got some notes. It's not, we're not completely winging it, but we're kind of winging it. But there's a conclusion. I'm excited to share with you the conclusion. If you're joining us for the first time, so, by the way, this could go any number of ways and we'll find out together. Either way, one of the biggest risks is that I'm not good at knowing when to stop. And so typically I have my notes and I try to make sure that they fit. So if I go past 11:02, somebody just raise your hand and be like, it's past 11:02, and I'll just be done. David and Goliath, famous story, right? Anybody here? David, kids especially. Any kids? This is like your favorite story. David and Goliath. We've been doing a series that we're calling Back to the Flannel Graph. Some of us grew up with flannel graphs. It looks like this. And we have been trying to, in a digital age, try to retell some of the stories using the old methods. And so this is a flannel graph. You lay the scenes on top, and so this will be our setting. As you're going to see, this is not at all going to be accurate to where the story actually takes place. There is a creek, if you could call it that, that winds through what will be the setting, which is the Valley of Elah, but it is dry most of the year, and even at flood stage, kind of in the winter rains, it is like this wide, and so it doesn't look like a Grand River kind of scene. But this will be our setting for the flannel graph. Here's the story as I grew up hearing the story. Once upon a time, there was a giant. His name was Goliath. We'll put him over here. And rawr is right. Giants always say rawr in fee-fi-fo-fum. Yes. There was a giant, and his name was Goliath. And Goliath was the bully in the story. He's a bad guy, and he's a really, really bad guy. And he has kind of targeted the people of Israel, the Hebrew people. And he's been taunting the people, like any classic bully would do. He's been taunting them to come fight him. Somebody fight me. And the people of Israel look around. The people of Israel look around. And initially they say, well, the king, a guy by the name of Saul, he should be the one to go fight Goliath. So let's send in the king. The king's going to fight Goliath. It's going to be good. But the king, as they go to the king and say, hey, king, would you fight for us? The king says, I don't want to fight that guy. He's huge. I don't want to fight Goliath. And so the king's afraid, and Goliath just keeps taunting, like, you babies, won't you fight me? Won't you fight me? And then they go to the people, the fiercest warriors, and then to all of the men, and they say, will anyone here fight Goliath? And every single person, all of the army, all the military, the strongest, the bravest, no one dares fight Goliath. Except for a boy, his name is? David. Which would make a great middle name. I got you. David is a shepherd. David's just a boy. David is not qualified to fight this guy in terms of like his size. He's got no military training. He can't even lift Saul's sword. Like, it's just too heavy for him. The armor doesn't fit on him. He's just a shepherd boy. But David says, I'll fight Goliath. And with some stones, 5 smooth stones. I remember that detail as a kid. 5 smooth stones, because anytime we used to have one of those kinds of, like Dennis the Menace, and a slingshot, and so we would always have to look for the smooth stones so we could kill the giants. But with 5 smooth stones, he goes and he takes a slingshot, and he doesn't need all 5 stones, he just needs 1 stone. He throws the slingshot, and he hits Goliath. Anybody remember where? In the forehead, yeah. And he hits him in the forehead, and Goliath comes tumbling down. And David, the shepherd boy, with no military training, beats the giant Goliath. And that's the story, as I remember it being told to me. It's a good story. There's a reason why David and Goliath has become kind of a cultural thing for us, right? Anytime you have an underdog, you often hear the phrase David and Goliath. Whether you grew up in church or not, you've heard the David and Goliath story. You've heard the metaphor of David and Goliath. This is a real David and Goliath situation. If you follow sports at all, that's like, it happens all the time. I was watching the Cape Verde game from a couple of weeks ago. Did anybody see this game versus Argentina? So Cape Verde versus Argentina, and the commentators talked about David and Goliath in that story and in that game. And if you follow the story, it was an incredible game. Cape Verde is like this small little island country in Africa, and the population is small, and they're playing Argentina with Lionel? Everyone pronounces it different. Lionel. I'm going to call him Lionel. Lionel Messi. Lionel Messi. The greatest, arguably the greatest soccer player of all time. Although I've learned to be careful saying that because everyone's got strong opinions on that one. Maybe the most well-paid, him and Ronaldo, the most well-paid soccer professionals of all time playing against Cape Verde. And I had heard, I've tried to fact check this, so please do. But the goalie was a part-time electrician, part-time bus driver, and then just kind of steps in and is playing in the game. Again, to fact check that one. But like the goalie who was, like, he blocked a bunch of messy shots, and it was a real David and Goliath situation. And that's the metaphor we use. And I get it. It's a good story. Here's the problem with the David and Goliath story as we tell it, okay? My opinion. The problem with the David and Goliath story as we tell it is deep within us, we know it's just not true. And not that it didn't happen. I think we actually have evidence. They found a city in this area called Shaaraim, and we're like archaeologists for the first time are like, oh, we found the location. And so like the story happened. But the reason we continue to tell the story is because the small guy beating the big guy, that portion of the story, the reason we use that as a metaphor is because it is the exception. It just tends to not happen. So while this moment in history, I think we can confidently say happened, when we look out at our world, we look out at a world and we say, well, this just doesn't really happen. Like, that's not how the world actually plays out. Cape Verde. Like, I was excited to watch the Cape Verde game because here's these real underdogs. And this goalie was amazing to watch. The amount of shots on goal that guy stopped. And they lost the game. That's actually how it goes most of the time in our life, right? Like that. Remember high school? Try to. High school, isn't it? Not the nice guys get the girl always, right? Isn't that how it always played out in high school? The quiet, shy guy, like he always ended up with the girl. Or the just the really nice girl, she always ended up with whatever guy she wanted, right? That's how it worked in your high school? No, it was always like the cocky guy and the bravado guy. It just, like our experience of the story, of real life, is like the underdog just tends not to win. The meanest tend to win, and the shrewdest tend to win. And so while the story may have happened, and we tell the story because it's the exception, our lived experience is far too often the Goliaths of our world are the ones that actually win. And I was thinking about that, and here's the thing. I think we've been telling the story wrong. I think that while we've gotten all of the details right, there is a critical detail in the David and Goliath story that we tend to leave out when we tell it to our kids in the way we've heard the story. And because of that, we've turned the story into this underdog story, which that's not the story. The story is not an underdog story. It's like David is an underdog, sure, but it's not an underdog story, but we've told it wrong. And for those of us who are up against any number of giants, I think we need the right telling of this particular story, right? If you've been fighting for a marriage and you look around and you realize the Goliaths seem to always win, divorce seems to win again and again, and when people are in my shoes, the little dog just doesn't. The right thing, I loved a lot, cancer, right? Cancer tends to win. The Goliath of cancer tends to win. And for those who are watching a loved one just going through the worst stuff, I think we need the true, full David and Goliath story. Because the story itself, for any of us who are rooting for an underdog, but also skeptical about whether the underdog can actually win against the big things, loneliness, addiction, depression, anxiety, we actually need the true story. So let's go back to the, we'll leave the flannel graph, and let's look at the story of David and Goliath, and eventually we'll get to, okay, so what is this full story? It's in 1 Samuel 17, 1 Samuel chapter 17. All right, I'll start us in verse 1. Did everyone find a chair? We had debated, like, hey, maybe we get to this date and we realize we fit very comfortably in here, and for the rest of the summer, we can just do one service. Sleeping in was kind of nice. all right, verse 1. Now, the Philistines. So what we'll do is we'll read the story, just the beginning of it. I just got a couple of things I want to share around background, and then we'll read about the moment where the battle happens, and then I have a conclusion for you. But let's start the story. Now, the Philistines gathered their forces for war and assembled at Succoth in Judah. They pitched camp at Ephes Damim between Succoth and Azekah. Saul and the Israelites assembled and camped in the valley of Elah and drew up their battle line to meet the Philistines. The Philistines occupied one hill and the Israelites another hill with a valley between them. A champion named Goliath, who was from Gath, came out of the Philistine camp. His height was 6 cubits and a span. And your Bible's going to have a little footnote. And it's like, depending on your translation, some will say it's like 9 feet tall. Others will say it's like 6'6". Okay, so either way, he's tall for the time. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he wore a coat of scale armor of bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. On his legs, he wore bronze greaves, and a bronze javelin was slung on his back. His spear shaft was like a weaver's rod. Okay, and his iron point weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went ahead of him. Goliath stood and shouted at the ranks of Israel, Why do you come at me and line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us. Then the Philistine said, this day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other. On hearing the Philistine's words, King Saul and all the Israelites were dismayed and terrified. And then David's going to come into the story. Now, couple of background pieces of information that will help us understand the story. First, let's think about the Philistines. We've come across this name before. Philistine simply means like sea people. We think they come out of Greece, but we're not exactly sure. What we know is that they occupy the Mediterranean coast. Honestly, there was 5 capital cities of the Philistines, and they're all in the area today known as the Gaza Strip. So that area, not great for tourism right now, but that area of the Gaza, it's a terrible, heartbreaking situation. That area is what was then the area where the Philistines are camped. Now, the Philistines are the bad guys in the story. They have been the bad guys now for a couple of generations. Do you remember the story we looked at a few weeks ago? The Samson story. Remember Samson? The Philistines are coming. Okay, so they were the bad guys a few generations earlier. They've been the bad guys now for a while. And Goliath is a trained soldier from the Philistines. Okay, so we've got a decades-old rivalry. Follow me so far. Okay, second, let's think about location. This story takes place in a valley known as the Valley of Elah. Let me show you a picture of it today. This is the Valley of Elah. This is taken from a place called Azekah, which is named. Where this is taken from is where the Philistines are camped. They're camped out on the hill in Azekah. To point out some things. Those back there are the Judean Mountains. This is where Israel, if you keep going, you get to Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and then Jerusalem. The valley kind of cuts and kind of winds that way. Israel's forces are camped in this hill area. And then you've got the Philistines camped all the way around this area, okay? And they're battling over the valley. There is a stream that flows. You can kind of see it here, and then this tree line there. There's a stream, but it's dry most of the year, but you can still pick up rocks. We do it every time, and, you know, we always make the same joke. If you find one with blood on it, that's mine. But you can pick up rocks if you're going to strike down a giant. This is where you're going to get your rocks. Okay, so that's the setting of our story. And maybe this will help. Imagination time. We got kids in the room. So kids, you're better at imagination than us adults. You're going to have to help us out. So imagine this stage is where the Philistines are camped. It says they're on one hill. So imagine where I'm standing. We've got the Philistine camp behind me. That means you've got, if you kind of follow it this way, you're going to have Bethlehem, and then further off into the hills, you're going to have Jerusalem. So you've got the Israelites are camped here with Saul and with David. David's actually back in Bethlehem when the story starts, but he's that way. Then over on another hill, we'll imagine it's back in this area. We've got, so you in the back, you're going to be the Philistines. So back here, kind of on a, by the way, Azekah is like 10 times taller than, so this kind of is close, about 10 times taller than where the Israelites are camped. Azekah, when we take a group there, we go to Azekah because you got a better vantage point. You can see the whole thing from Azekah. So you've got the better turf. You understand what's at stake. Everyone down here on the floor, you're in the valley. During times of peace, this is where you farm. During times of peace, this is where you travel. You don't want to travel over a mountain. You want to travel through the valley. So you have the roads run through the valley. Now, the valley itself is kind of shaped like this room. It kind of starts by Azekah and kind of cuts across. It starts by the Mediterranean Sea. So behind you is the Mediterranean Sea. It kind of comes and winds its way and then makes its way over here. And then we'll continue all the way down to Bethlehem and Jerusalem. This is known as the Valley of Elah. It's one of five valleys. You can take your hand on a map and do this, and you essentially have the five valleys that will cut east-west. There's only five. The biggest is the Jezreel Valley, but then there are four others that if you're going to cut and skip the mountains, you got five options. So the Philistines know that if we can control the valley, we can control the road. But eventually, these Israelites who have been a nuisance to us, we can make it all the way back to their home base, and we can take them down. Okay, so these have been fighting for a while now, and Goliath represents this group of people. Am I with me on geography? Okay, third observation. When we read about Goliath, we are told that Goliath is a tall gentleman. We are told that he's a giant, and by any standards, he's a giant. But that is not the thing the author wants you to catch first and foremost. The author names his height. It's a big deal. But that's not the thing the author names multiple times. When the author talks about Goliath, what is the thing the author will often say connected to Goliath? See if you know your story. Or if you... It's Goliath from Gath. At least twice, Goliath is directly connected to Gath. So it's not Goliath the giant, it's Goliath the guy from Gath. Now, why does that matter? Some backstory. About 45 years before this particular story, or 12 chapters in your Bible. There's an incident that happens in Gath. And the incident, we spent a whole sermon on it like a year or two ago. So I won't recap the whole incident. Here's the abbreviated version of the incident. The Philistines and the Israelites are fighting. I'll come back on stage. Are fighting with one another. And the Philistines win 45 years earlier. They win. And not only do they win, when they win, as spoils of war, they take the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the Ark of the Covenant's a big deal. Why? Who lived there? God said, I will live there. You build me a box, and I'll live there on the box so that you'll know that I'm always with you. Wherever you go, I go. So it was like a visual reminder that God's with the people. His Shekinah manifest glory is with them. The Philistines take the Ark of the Covenant. And when they take the Ark of the Covenant, they bring the Ark of the Covenant back to their five capital cities. And they bring the Ark of the Covenant into the temple of their main god. Philistines are the sea people. So they bring it to their main god, who's a fish-headed god who goes by the name of Dagon. Okay, so Dagon's the god of the Philistines. And they bring it into the temple of Dagon, and then they leave. And the next morning, the statue of Dagon has fallen and is face down in front of the Ark of the Covenant, which is like the universal sign and our symbol in our Bible of worship, right? They fell face down. So you got the statue of Dagon, and it's like, okay, that's not cool. So they pick up the statue. The next day, it happens again, and then again. And then they notice something else happens. By the way, the third time, his head and his hands of the statue of Dagon are broken off and placed on the mantle, which is like a teaser for how the David and Goliath story is going to end. But we have children here, so I'll let you read the end of the story. They also start to realize that everyone in the community is getting really sick, like really, really, really sick. And they don't know what to do about it. It's like gross stuff, too. It's like pus and rashes and ugh. And so they make the connection that maybe the reason we're getting sick is because we captured their God, and their God is getting us sick. So what they decide to do is take the Ark of the Covenant, load it between some cattle, put it on a cart, and then send the Ark of the Covenant to a different city. It stops at another Philistine city. Then they all get sick. Pus and boils and rashes. So they ship it to another Philistine city, and another Philistine city. It keeps happening. Everyone's getting sick. So eventually they say, we don't want this box anymore. Whatever's going on here is getting us all sick. So they load it up on some cows, on a wagon, I guess. And they say, like, giddy up, get out of here. And the cows make their way. They just kind of go, and they say, wherever it goes, it goes, but just get it out of here. The cows make their way all the way up the valley. They stop just shy of Jerusalem in a city called Kiriat Yaarim. Have you heard this word before? Yeah, Jeremy, remember he talked about in the Let Me Tell You a Story? Kiriat Yaarim. So that's where that story started. But there's this, like, long history. Now, one of the things Goliath from Gath, one of those cities. One of the things we're going to read about Goliath is that he's been a trained soldier since youth. He's been fighting and training since he was a boy. We also know that he is going to come and he's going to defy or curse the Israelites by his gods. So 45 years earlier, Dagon was humiliated. And now we got Goliath coming in and saying, okay, you may have embarrassed us 45 years earlier, but now it's payback time. I've been training for this. I'm bigger than you. Who wants to fight me? Winner take all. Who wants to come at me? Background detail number three. It doesn't matter, I guess. Four. Let's talk about a guy named Saul. So we have three main characters in our story. You have David. We'll get to David in a minute. We've got Goliath, the guy from Gath, the giant. And then we got a guy by the name of Saul. Saul's the king. He's the one. By the way, why is Saul the king? What was the reason they wanted Saul of all the Israelite people? Why did they say, we want Saul to lead us first? Do you remember what the people saw in Saul? He's tall. They say, you're tall. You could lead us. Like, it was about that deep, right? Like, you're tall. You'll lead us. So the language they actually use when they say you can lead us because you're tall is that we want a king who can fight our battles for us. So do you remember the movie Troy? Right, the beginning of the movie Troy, you've got this, like, these two armies come together and they're trying to figure out, like, how do we not have all of our men die? What if instead of everyone fighting each other, you send a delegate, your fiercest soldier, and we'll send our fiercest soldier, and those two will fight, and it's winner take all. Okay, so their guy's, like, really big, and then everyone's trying to find Brad Pitt. He's Achilles, and then there's a fight that happens. But that's kind of what Goliath wants here. It's like, I'll fight your fiercest warrior, winner takes all. And you got a guy who's chosen to be king because he's tall. Not only is he tall, the book of Judges tells us that that Saul is from the tribe of Benjamin, and Benjamin were known throughout Israel as being the fiercest soldiers, trained since their youth. There is a verse in Judges, I don't have it up here, but there's a verse in Judges that says that there were soldiers out of Benjamin who could sling a stone, and I quote, could strike a single hair. So Saul is the king, Saul is tall, and Saul has training, at least his people have training, in which they could sling a stone and hit an individual hair. This is supposed to be Saul's fight, and Goliath knows it. And so Goliath says, where's your king? Have him come fight me. This is supposed to be a battle between two tall dudes. Right? Winner takes all. But Saul is scared. Saul says, no, I'm not fighting. So they look around and they try to find anyone who's going to fight. They look at the other fierce soldiers and no one's moving for 40 days. The text tells us that every day, at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day, Saul comes down, or Goliath comes into the valley. So, like, right here, stands in front of the Philistines and taunts them. Taunts them. Who's going to fight? Who's going to do it? Now, why does morning and evening, why is that a big deal? The Bible has a prayer, and you're to pray it every morning and every evening. It's called Shema in our Bible. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord alone. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Every day, they pray this prayer in the morning, and I can't say for certain that this is what's going on, but I think Goliath hears him say that prayer, and he says, if your God is so good, come fight me. And every evening when they say the prayer, come on, we're right here. Come fight me. And Saul says, no. And then the fiercest soldiers say, no. And so then they go looking for anyone who would fight. And for 40 days, we have an entire nation standing on a hill, terrified, frozen in fear. Until David, let's talk about David. Is David qualified to fight? I mean, not by the standards of Goliath, right? Like, he's a boy. The Bible tells us he's ruddy and handsome. The translation of that word ruddy means he's got smooth baby face. Literally, it means he's not of the age in which he can grow facial hair yet. He's a prepubescent boy. He's a little boy. The text also tells us that David's got he's a shepherd, and that David's been called by his dad to go take some goat milk, make some cheese, and bring it to all of the men who are fighting in Israel. Which is like a subtle way of saying, you're a little boy, bring them cheese, bring the men who are fighting cheese, but you're not a man, you're a little boy. But David goes on that mission to bring cheese, and he sees what's happening, and David says, if no one's moving, I'll fight him. He can't fit in the armor. He can't lift the sword. All those are true. But David says, I'll fight him. Do you remember why David thinks he's qualified? I just saw the clock. Remember why David says he's qualified? Okay, 11:06. David says he's qualified. I won't find it here. David says he's qualified because he struck down a lion when they were trying to attack the sheep. A bear came and tried to attack the sheep, and he struck down the bear. And then there's this verse, and David, I think this is a secret to David, verse 37. He says, this wasn't me. The Lord who rescued me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear will rescue me from the hand of the Philistine. Why does David think he's qualified? God. David's like, this isn't a battle between a little guy and a big guy. This is a battle between our God and them. And in that situation, I'm not the underdog. I'm not the underdog. Let's read the story. What happens next? Verse 41. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bearer in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looked David over and saw that he was little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome. And he despised him. He said to David, am I a dog that you come at me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. Come here, he said, and I will give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals. David said to the Philistine, you come against me with sword and spear and javelin, and I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down and cut off your head. This day, this very day, I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds and the wild animals, and the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword, it is not by spear that the Lord saves, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into our hands. As the Philistine moved closer to attack him, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet him. Reaching into his bag and taking out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine on the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell face down on the ground, just like who? Dagon! So David triumphed over the Philistine with a sling and a sword. Without a sword in his hand, he struck the Philistine and killed him. David ran and stood over him. He took hold of the Philistine's sword, drew it, and did some stuff with the sword. Okay. Very subtle. Okay, here's an aha for me in the story. Well, let's name a first aha that we just have to name. This is not a battle of David versus Goliath. We told the story wrong. This is a battle of God versus Goliath. Listen, if the giant you're facing is a marriage that has zero love, and if all you're banking on is that maybe in the end a little bit of love will win, unfortunately, Goliath wins almost all the time. But if God gets the last word, and we can surrender to God and say, God, the battle belongs to you. God can take down those giants. Now, maybe this marriage doesn't work. I don't know. But in the end, loneliness will not win. It doesn't win. The Bible ends with us around a table with all tribes, language, peoples, and nations. Cancer is a Goliath. And it has cost many of us, if not all of us, somebody that we love closely. And in the end, death does not get the last word. God gets the last word. Anxiety is a Goliath that I know a lot of us face. And in the moment, it might feel like there's nothing I can do. My thoughts are so far beyond my ability to control them. But in the end, God gets the final word. We get restored minds, restored bodies. Here's a detail in the story, though, that has struck me as I was on a walk. Did you notice in the story, this whole story is a group of people frozen in fear until David steps out. And the text doesn't say that David walks out to Goliath. The text tells us that David does what? Runs. And then if you keep reading, verse 51. When the Philistines saw that their hero was dead, they turned and ran. Then the men of Israel and Judah surged toward them with a shout and pursued the Philistines to the entrance of Gath. Up until this moment, everyone's frozen in fear. When David runs, David trusts God. When David runs, we find a whole nation ready to move again. Up until this point, David, no one dares fight a giant. After the story, David is going to have a group of followers. They're going to refer to as David's mighty men. And these followers, on at least four occasions, were told that they stood up to giants and took them down. Sometimes the right thing to do is hard and no one else is willing to do it. And sometimes it requires a person of great faith to go first, to do the hard thing, so that those behind you have the courage to go. And the beauty, of course, which brings us to Jesus. Jesus took a nation, a community, a people. They were torn and frozen in every direction, right? They, Jew versus Gentile, Roman versus Israel, Essene versus Zealot versus Pharisee versus Sadducee. Everyone's torn, everyone's frozen, and Jesus stands in the middle. And because of that, you and I are here today as a reconciling body. Let me end with a story that was told to me. This is a friend of mine was telling me a story one night. I was 24 or 5. He had a family. I was still, I wasn't married even at the time. But he was telling me a story about his son. He said, you know, it actually took place at the seminary in the Red Bricks. He said, I was watching the kids play in the Red Bricks, and they were playing a game called freeze tag. And he said, all the kids were out playing freeze tag, and I'm watching my little boy, and he's running, and he's playing. And then it got darker and darker, and now they're playing under the streetlights. And he said, I'm watching this game, and my boy gets frozen. And so my boy is like, you know freeze tag rules, right? He gets frozen. And my boy just starts shouting, like, I'm frozen, please, somebody touch me, somebody help me, I'm frozen. But he was way away from the streetlights. And so my friend said he waited like a minute, and he watched his boy. I'm frozen. Somebody touch me. Help me. And another minute passed, and then another minute passed. And he's like, I'm like a dad, and this is my only child. And he's like, I'm like heartbroken over here. Like, come on, somebody help my kid out. Like, I don't want this to be a weird core memory. Help him out. And then I said, did anyone do it? And he goes, oh. I go, what did you do? And he goes, I checked myself into the game. And he said, I ran and I just started touching all the kids that nobody was seeing, including my own boy. And I just said, go, you're free. You're unfrozen. Go. And that story has always stuck with me because I think for so many of us, we find ourselves up against giants and we forget. We think it's about David and Goliath, and we see ourselves as David, and we're frozen and we're away from the street lamp. And we forget that our God checked himself into the game and wants to come up to each of us and say, go, run, you're no longer frozen. That giant does not get the last word. We're going to do communion this morning. If you've yet to say yes to Jesus, I just want to invite you to make this the day where you say, you know what, this act of faith as I take bread and juice, this is my day of saying, God, I don't want to fight this giant anymore. It's too big for me. How do we take communion here? We've got just little squares of bread. You'll take the bread and then dip it into the cup and take individually. There's four stations. The two on the end have a gluten-free option. Just let them know if you want a gluten-free option. Abby Black, maybe. She's probably setting up for our fun day. Someone will be in the back. Just raise a hand if you can't make your way to the front. We'll figure it out. Somebody hear me in that. But would you join me for a word of prayer? Heavenly Father, I pray for... Although, let me just start with the little kids. For every little kid who's scared right now, for whatever it is, oh Lord, for every little kid who maybe camp is in the next couple weeks and they've not done that before and that's scary. Lord, maybe they're going to a new school this year. Maybe they are going back to a school where this last year wasn't very good. And Lord, for every kid in our church who's scared, Lord, I pray that you would remind them that you have checked yourself in, Lord, that you are with them. Lord, for everyone who's in the season of life where the responsibilities are starting to weigh, they're getting heavier and heavier. And there's all this pressure to have it done a certain way at a certain time frame. Lord, I just pray that you would remind them that you have checked yourself into the game. Lord, for everyone here who is just bored by life, Lord, would you remind them that you're a God of infinite opportunity. You're a God of joy. Lord, help us to shake free from the mundane. And then, Lord, for everyone here who's grieving, anxious, depressed, Lord, as we take communion, would you remind us that we come as a community? We are your hands and feet in this earth, Lord. You told us that. And so, Lord, would you hug your church, and would you use our arms to do it? Would you encourage your church, and would you use our words to do it? Jesus, we love you, and we pray this in your name. Amen.
For more information about how you can become a part of the South Harbor Church community, find us on the web at www.southharbor.org or find us on Facebook and Instagram at South Harbor Church. And on Sunday mornings, you can find our service streamed live at 8:45 a.m. on Facebook and YouTube. And so from all of us here at South Harbor Church, we want to wish you a blessed week.